Seated, please. Court is ready to hear argument in 10-0776, Jack Edward Milner versus Vicki Ann Milner. Justice Willett is sitting in this cause but could not be here for the oral argument.
May it please the court, Mr. Cobes will present argument for the petitioner. Petitioner has reserved 5 minutes for rebuttal.
May it please the court, my name is Jeff Cobes. I'm a lawyer from Fort Worth. I'm here today on behalf of petitioner Jack Milner, who was the husband in a divorce proceeding pending in Tarrant County. We are asking the court today to set aside the judgment of the Court of Appeals and reinstate the judgment of the trial court below. The judgment of the trial court below enforced the mediated settlement agreement.
Let me ask you something, Mr. Cobes. You're arguing that contract principles shouldn't apply in this situation. Now, when you look at mediation, which is certainly very, very important in the area of family law, where we want people to be able to continue their family relationships after the end of the litigation, so there's a huge presumption in favor of mediation. But doesn't the principle underline that? Isn't it that the parties actually have a meeting of the mind and they actually are agreeing to whatever it is that is going to resolve the controversy?
I think there's two answers to that. I agree with you that mediation is favored, particularly in the family law context. However, the mediated settlement agreement statute, 6.602 of the Family Code, which had a predecessor, but which has been in place now for 12 years, never construed by this court or ruled upon by this court, states very clearly in Section C that if the terms of the statute are complied with, in other words, the language, the boldness, the signatures, etc., the statute says, if a mediated settlement agreement meets the requirements of this section, a party is entitled to judgment on a mediated settlement agreement, notwithstanding Rule 11 or another rule of law.
But doesn't there have to be an agreement in order for that to apply?
And in this case, clearly there was an agreement. There was an agreement that was embodied in the mediated settlement agreement that was signed by the parties.
What about the problem with the partnership and the fact that the other partners had to agree to what they had agreed to and one of them wouldn't?
That's not a problem. In the mediated settlement agreement, there was no contingency. There was not even an agreement that they would seek to obtain the approval of the other partners. There were forms attached in which Jack Milner signed his consent, but this mediated settlement agreement is completely silent as to any party's obligation to obtain the other partner's signatures. And in other words, there was one aspect of the agreement that was contingent.
Isn't that where the agreement is flawed within itself?
No, Your Honor, I don't believe so, because if the other parties had consented and had voluntarily signed the sections where they could have, then the assignment of the interest would have taken place and Mrs. Milner, Vicki, would have had the assigned partnership agreement. By withholding their consent, the interest is still assigned. The partnership agreement permits the interest to be assigned without the consent of the other partners and pursuant to a divorce decree. It simply then allows the other partners, by withholding their consent, to enforce a buyout provision, obtain an appraisal, and buy that interest out. Everybody knew that.
You mentioned the divorce decree. Does the divorce decree alter the MSA terms?
It does not. It enforces them strictly.
Right. Assume that it does. I'm not saying you're conceding. Assume that it does alter the MSA terms. What is the remedy in that event if we find that it does?
Then you would find that I would lose and that the Court of Appeals was correct, because trial judges are not free to take mediated settlement agreements and alter the terms of those settlement agreements on their own initiative. In this case, there's an argument set forth that the divorce decree attaches an exhibit, an assignment of the interest as an exhibit to the divorce decree that is different than the exhibits that were attached to the mediated settlement agreement. And that's absolutely correct because there's two different purposes. Attached to the mediated settlement agreement were consents, partnership consents to an assignment Jack Milner signed them as he promised to do in the mediated settlement agreement. Attached to the divorce decree was the actual transfer, the actual assignment, the deed, so to speak, to the partnership. There was no assignment attached to the mediated settlement agreement.
Are the legal consequences of those separate attachments different, though?
Yes. The attachment to the divorce decree actually assigns the interest as it was agreed to between the parties. The consents that were not executed by the other partners that were attached to the mediated settlement agreement provide an entirely different purpose. They are not transfer documents, they're consents.
Yes, sir. Did the consents form an integral part of the MSA?
According to the MSA itself, Jack's agreement to consent to his assignment of the interest to Vicki was required, and he did give that consent.
So that agreement was essential to fulfillment of the terms of the MSA?
Jack's agreement, or Jack's consent. If Jack had refused to consent, then that would have been a violation.
The consents reflected in the attachment to the MSA, were those consents a substantial part of that MSA?
According to the MSA, the consent of Jack was an integral part.
How many signatures were on the attachment, the consent attachments in the MSA?
Well, for Vicki signed as a spouse, but there were three partners, so there were three blanks for partners to consent. Jack agreed to consent in the MSA. The other partners were not parties to the MSA and weren't there and never agreed to consent or did.
So back to my question, was that consent agreement a substantial portion of the MSA in order to effectuate the terms?
I've tried to answer that, but I think maybe I understand where you're going now. There was no requirement in the MSA that the other partners consent. So it was not an integral part. It was not a requirement at all that the other partners consent.
And how does that differ from the what you're calling transfer deeds attached to the decree?
The decree attached an assignment of a partnership interest. It's a legal assigning document. It didn't require anybody else to sign it. It was just, I, Jack Milner, hereby convey and assign my beneficial interest and right and title to my partnership interest.
So just so that I understand this, when they were negotiating and preparing documents during that mediation, three partners were going to consent. But somehow when they got in front of the trial judge and prepared a decree, that those three signatures became one signature.
I disagree with that.
Okay.
There was never an agreement between Jack and Vicki that the other partners would consent. There was no contingency in the MSA that required the other partners to consent. There wasn't even a language that Jack would try and get the other partners to consent. Well,
that sort of flies in the face of the attachment, though. You have signature lines for the two other partners, but you're telling me no one even considered that an important aspect.
What the parties considered important at the mediation was that Jack would consent. In other words, Jack agreed not only to convey his interest, but to consent to the conveyance. So he couldn't go back, and so decided.
But how could he do that? He couldn't consent for the other partners.
Of course not. He could agree to consent for himself, and that was sufficient. The mediated settlement agreement was signed. It was fully enforceable. The partnership interest would transfer. If the other partners consented, then Vicki would retain the partnership interest. If they elected to withhold their consent, then she would be bought out at a predetermined appraised price. That was the deal. Jack completely complied with it. It was evident in the face of it. Both parties were represented by counsel. It was a multi-million dollar divorce. The mediator was a former judge.
If you were Mrs. Milner's lawyer, you would have put in this, made the agreement contingent on the partners all signing, or at the very least, the husband doing everything in his power to persuade their signatures.
If I was Mrs. Milner's lawyer and it was important to Mrs. Milner that she not only received the partnership interest but that she kept it, then yes, I would certainly have put that in there. Her lawyer didn't. And that creates the whole problem and really why we're here, and I hope why this court granted the petition for review and is sharing this argument today. The problem with going back and looking at meeting of the minds and unexpressed or expressed intentions, hopes, desires, expectations to be realized from the settlement is the very thing that the mediated settlement agreement statute, in my opinion, was designed to avoid. Here's a deal, we've got a deal, but a day later, a week later, a month later, I've thought about it, I don't like the deal anymore, or I've failed to include something that I wanted to include, but I didn't. And it will open up all of these mediated settlement agreements to second guessing, to evidence before the trial court. The courts of appeal have been very clear, this court hasn't dealt with it, but they have found that fraudulent inducement, duress, coercion, whatever that may be, I know this court's wrestling with that, dishonesty, illegality, those are the types of things that can set aside a mediated settlement agreement.
But
so there is a remedy.
Excuse me, but in this case, if it would be impossible in order to comply with it, because, in fact, if the intent was that in order to have a fair, or maybe not fair, but what they agreed upon, division of the property, she was going to get the partnership, and if that was, in fact, not possible because of the fact that these other partners need to sign off, then doesn't that have an impact?
If the question is impossibility of performance a ground to set aside a mediated settlement agreement, no court of appeal that I have seen has squarely addressed that question.
But you're not looking to impossibility. You're looking for the value that was attached to that. So it doesn't matter if they signed it or not, right?
Right. We don't have impossibility in our case because the agreement was to transfer the interest. That was the only agreement. And the interest was transferred. So there's nothing impossible about it. If there had been an agreement to obtain the other partner's consent or for her to actually become a limited partner, which is a whole other issue, then you might have that question. But the mediated settlement agreement is silent as to those things. There's a contingency in it with respect to lenders, so they knew how to draft contingency language, but this is not a contingency. There's a best efforts clause in there. Jack agreed to use his best efforts to get the cell phone company to transfer a cell phone number into her name. The agreement was a contingent on it, but he at least agreed to try, and he did. He did not, in this agreement, even agree to try to get the other partners to consent. So if it was of that much importance, I mean, there's a lot of other property that was divided in this case, but if it was that important to Vicki that she not only received the valuable partnership interest, but that she be allowed to, as she stated, I think, in her motion for new trial affidavit, occupy Jack's office, have a car allowance, have a salary, all those other things that she wanted to do as part of the limited partnership, it simply should have been in the agreement.
Couldn't Vicki have expected the trial court to enter a decree that reflected the terms of the MSA, including a place for those other two partners to sign? Wasn't that a reasonable expectation on her part?
I would not think so, because the other partners weren't before the court.
Why have them in there then? Why have those two signature lines in that attachment if they weren't going to be in the attachment with respect to the decree? And I understand the problems of bringing them into the lawsuit, but I'm asking you, why wouldn't it be the same?
When a lawyer, and I'll be honest with you, I was not trial counsel for either party, but a lawyer clearly prepared those consents. They're pretty standard consents for action by the limited partnership and the LLC that was its managing partner. When you're going to prepare a consent for partners to sign, whether it's a consent to admit a new partner or a consent to ratify or a consent to waive the minutes or whatever, you're going to put all the partners' names in there, so that when it's fully executed, everybody would have consented to it. But the agreement didn't require those other partners to consent, only Jack. And Jack signed where he was supposed to.
Can you effectuate the transfer of assets contemplated in the agreement without the signatures of the other partners?
Yes, certainly. And it was. The entire partnership interest that Jack owned in both the partnership and the management company was effectively assigned as part of the MSA.
Is her voting right or potential voting right, had she become a full partner, sort of an asset, if you will, that was also contemplated on being divided?
She was never going to become a voting partner, even if the other partners had signed. There were consents to the assignment, not consents to admit her as a partner. So even
so, is the main issue the salary and the car allowance, basically?
Well, and I guess voting, I mean, that could have been negotiated, and perhaps the other partners might have admitted her. I suspect it had something to do with her financial ability, her ability to incur debt, but I don't know that to be the case. But the point is, that wasn't negotiated, and it wasn't part of the agreement. What was part of the agreement was he would give up his entire interest to her, and she would obtain it. And she would either keep it if the other partners consented, not as a partner, but as an assignee, or it would be subject to sale. And that was the only thing that was in the agreement. To go beyond that, to go exploring into what the expectations were, I think is very problematic. I see my time is up. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. The court is ready to hear argument from the respondent.
May it please the court, Ms. Tillery will present argument for the respondent.
May it please the court. As the justices know, the civil bar would absolutely love to have the statute that we have in family law. Section 6.602 of the Texas Family Code is unique to family law, and it's an important mechanism that needs to be preserved. We're asking you today to affirm the judgment of the Court of Appeals, and I'm here today to explain why that is not going to open up the floodgates to other appellate challenges. If the court will bear with me and flip to the actual opinion of the Court of Appeals, and I'm looking on my page 10. The actual holding of the Court of Appeals is extremely narrow and extremely limited. I'm reading from the opinion when I state, because the MSA contemplated unanimous consent and therefore a limited partnership interest for Vicki, but the divorce decree contemplated only an assignment, and because the rights of a limited partner are greater than those of an assignee under the partnership agreement, we hold there was no meeting of the minds regarding the transfer of the partnership agreement.
Can I ask you, what is your response to his argument that the agreement was that either she would get the partnership if the other partners agree, or she would get the value thereof, and in either situation, she would get her part of the property division that was agreed to. What's your response to that?
My response to that is twofold, Your Honor. First of all, I think the documents, both the MSA and those two attached exhibits, Exhibit A and B, are 100% clear and unambiguous, and you can look within the four corners of that document. You don't have to get into what did Vicki think, what did Jack think, what was said at mediation, what was insinuated. You can look simply within the four corners of that document, and you can see without a doubt that what was bargained for and what was negotiated for was full limited partnership interest.
So is it your argument that regardless that what was signed, that signed document, if we look at that period, that controls?
Absolutely, Your Honor. Absolutely. We are not the one up here trying to get out of the deal that we made. We're not the one that's trying to rewrite the deal, renegotiate the deal, go back and figure out what did everybody think that day in mediation.
But I thought the Court of Appeal said there was no meeting of the minds.
Your Honor is absolutely correct. They use that phrase.
And there's no agreement if there's no meeting of the minds.
Well, the paragraph I just read to you is the actual holding of the Court of Appeals. And what it's centering its quote-unquote no meeting of the minds phrase on is actually the variance between what the MSA said and what the final decree of divorce said. It was apples and oranges. In the mediated settlement agreement, without a doubt, looking at those exhibits A and B, looking at the language that it used, what was bargained for and what was exchanged was full partnership interest. You go look at the final decree of divorce.
Well, just so I'll be clear, you think there was a meeting of the minds on the mediated settlement?
Absolutely, Your Honor. Right. There was a meeting of the minds with regard to that mediated settlement agreement. It's unambiguous.
So the parties just disagree on what the meeting was?
I believe if you're going to look at what the intent of the parties was, you look within the four corners of the documents, and I think it's as clear as day.
Nothing in there that says the other partners would agree.
Well, there's nothing in there that says specifically that Jack is going to get their agreement. I agree with that. But when you actually look at Exhibit A and B, at the top, they're entitled Required Consent, and it's a capital R and it's a capital C, and that is a term of art that's defined in the partnership agreement.
Were Jack's partners involved in this discussion during the settlement?
As far as I know, Your Honor, they were not. I don't believe that they were.
Could Jack compel them to sign over their interests or agree to the arrangement?
I don't think Jack could compel them to sign the agreement. I think the agreement within the four corners of it shows that what was bargained for was full partnership interest. And Jack said on page 4 of that mediated settlement agreement, I agree to transfer to Vicki beneficial interest and record title. That's another term of art that when you go look at the partnership agreement and you look at what does required consent mean, capital R, capital C, and what does beneficial interest and record title mean, they mean unanimous consent.
So I'm sorry.
Thank you, Justice Green. Did Jack have the authority to convey that unilaterally? Beneficial interest and record title.
I don't believe I believe he was saying, I agree to give you this, and this means unanimous consent.
Jack had the authority to convey beneficial title and record, beneficial interest and record title without the signature of his partners.
I don't believe he did. And I think that leads to the conclusion that's also found in the Court of Appeals decision, particularly in Justice Gardner's concurring opinion, that in addition to the fact that there was this enormous variance between what the MSA said and what the decree said, in addition to that, there was also concerns because of this impossibility of performance.
It's really more of a failure of consideration. And he did everything he could that he had the power to do to effectuate this agreement, but it fell short of what you say that your client was entitled to get under that MSA. Right? So the agreement fails for lack of consideration.
I think there's a couple different ways you could phrase it, to tell you the truth. I think lack of consideration, I think, you could kind of skew it and say it was some kind of mutual mistake, maybe. But I think what it boils down to in the end is impossibility of performance. Because the parties contracted for, negotiated for, and bargained for something that wound up through, let's assume for the sake of the argument, that there was no dishonesty going on, that they just couldn't perform it.
But how could a partner ever enter into an agreement in a partnership which would compel one of his partners to take on a partner that maybe they don't want?
I think you're absolutely right. I don't think that could happen.
But the only thing he could do was to bargain with in the context of what he was empowered to do, which is what he did, it sounds to me like.
And I do not disagree that Jack did not have the power to compel his partners to agree to this transfer, and that's why it was an impossibility of performance. And then when that came to the trial court's consideration, when it came before the trial court, what the trial court should have done was set aside that mediated settlement agreement. There's a few other circumstances in the reported decisions where trial courts have set aside a mediated settlement agreement because there was some tremendous problem with it.
But the statute that you think we should uphold doesn't allow that. It says if you meet these conditions, that's it.
But the statute also, markedly, notably, doesn't prohibit a trial court from looking at the agreement and reviewing it before it goes forward to enforce it. And if you have a situation like
this...
It
seems to me you're arguing that these should just be treated like any other agreements.
I respect the
family bar went to a lot of trouble to get this statute passed.
Absolutely, and it's an important statute. And you know what? It still absolutely prohibits anyone from coming back a few days later and saying, well, I've changed my mind. I don't like the deal I got into. I don't think it's fair. I think we said it was a separate property when maybe... I mean, it still prohibits that. The Milner versus Milner decision at the Court of Appeal level doesn't change that. It doesn't change the fact that if someone unilaterally repudiates their consent, that doesn't make the deal unenforceable. It doesn't make the deal go away. 6.602 still has teeth. All that the Milner court was pointing out was that, number one, because of this tremendous difference between the MSA and the divorce decree, that difference between the two documents resulted in a quote-unquote no meeting of the minds. And secondly, the Court of Appeals expressed the concerns about the glaring, tremendous contingency that was there, that Your Honors are pointing out. Jack could not make his partners agree to this. But when you look within the four corners of the MSA, that's what was bargained for, was unanimous consent.
But the wife was represented. The wife's lawyer had to know that Jack could only convey what he owned, right? So how was there any disagreement over what the terms were?
And Your Honor, you know, neither myself or Mr. Cobbs were the trial counsel, and we weren't present at that mediation. And furthermore, I think as another public policy concern here, I think mediation procedures as much as possible should be kept confidential for the purpose of encouraging settlement. So I don't even think we have to go there. I don't think we have to get into what was said or not said. In this case, we have documents attached to this MSA and incorporated that are clear within the four corners. All you have to do is look at these terms of art that were used, and these terms of art that are defined in the partnership agreement, and the intent of the parties is clear. Unanimous consent is what was bargained for, and that equates to full partnership interest.
Is that a form over substance argument, though?
I don't believe so, Your Honor, because when there's no allegations that there's any ambiguity, and I don't think really either side is saying there's ambiguity, then all you can do to determine the intent of the parties is look to the four corners of the document, and that's what it looks like. And furthermore, Your Honor, if you look at the MSA as a whole, Mr. Milner is taking the vast majority of the hard assets. He's taking the cars and the real property and the cash and some of those things, and what was Ms. Milner taking in exchange was the partnership interest. So even just reviewing the MSA, you start to wonder, why in the world would she have agreed to this?
Is that partnership interest without any value, without the consent of the other partners?
It's absolutely a powerless, voiceless, assignee type interest, where all she gets is a huge K-1 each year with the pass-through partnership taxation. She cannot has no rights to compel any distributions. She has no voting rights to try to get out of the deal. And furthermore, after mediation, approximately 2 weeks after the mediation occurred, one of the limited partners, Joey Milner, who's Mr. Milner's brother, sold his 20% interest to the other limited partner, Michael Hill. And so when Vicki was at mediation and signing these documents, it said she was going to take 44% interest. The other two partners had roughly 35% and 20%. Then 2 weeks after mediation, in violation of the standing order that's in place in Tarrant County, that interest was sold and Jack consented to it. And so now all of a sudden, Ms. Milner is faced with a situation where instead of being the interest holder that had the greatest share, 44%, she's now a minority interest holder.
But a partner always buys into that. That could have happened a year later, 10 years later.
Absolutely, Your Honor, but the difference is we hadn't even had a final decree yet.
Well, what difference is it? It seems to me you're running the risk that one partner's going to sell to another, partners are going to sell out, whatever.
The difference in this case is that there's evidence that reflects that Mr. Milner knew at the time of mediation that this sale was imminent and didn't say anything, and that Ms. Milner didn't know. And I'll be the first to tell you the record is not 100% clear on those facts. I think they were contested facts.
And the trial court held a hearing on those, and the trial court listened to both of them and took that evidence into consideration and still entered the decree that is under consideration here.
Yes, Your Honor. The trial court did consider those facts and went ahead and entered the decree. But the difference is the trial court entered a decree that 180 degrees changes the deal from what the MSA said.
Well, you know, you were pointing out the Court of Appeals language just a moment ago. The Court of Appeals also said it says in the MSA, Jack and Vicki agreed to execute the required consents. And then it goes and talks about the exhibits. But the Court of Appeals says that unanimous consent was contemplated. But the Court of Appeals opinion itself says the only people who agreed to sign those consents were Jack and Vicki.
And that's absolutely correct. But what the Court of Appeals saw is that when you look at Exhibit A and B of the MSA, they use these terms of art that mean something under the partnership agreement. And the entire MSA is subject to the partnership agreement. So when we see at the top required consent to transfer beneficial interest in record title.
Well, the entire agreement is subject to the MSA subject to the partnership agreement, but seems to me like that's putting the cart before the horse. Isn't the partnership agreement and the partnership interest an asset that these two people were dealing with? Whatever that asset is, it's a property interest. So the MSA agreement deals with a lot more than that partnership interest, correct?
Absolutely.
So that it seems to me like it's the MSA agreement that makes the partnership interest part and subsidiary to the MSA in this instance.
I don't disagree with that analysis, and I think that's probably correct. But the reason it matters in this case is because when you start seeing these defined terms of art in the MSA, you have to figure out, what did the parties mean by this? Why did they use the term required consent? Why did they use the term beneficial interest and record title? It obviously means something. And then you go look at the partnership agreement, and sure enough, it's defined there. That means unanimous consent, because
Let me ask you two questions. Did the partnership agreement say Jack and Vicki agreed to sign the consents?
Yes, it did.
Did the partnership agreement say that Jack would guarantee or even use best efforts to get anyone else to sign the consents?
It didn't say that, and I think the reason is because it was so clear from what the exhibits A and B were. This wasn't a case where, you know, it was about the existing lenders and he was going to give his best efforts. Those exhibits A and B had signature lines for Michael Hill and for Joey Milner.
Well, if the divorce decree had mirrored the MSA, if the attachment to the divorce decree was exactly like the attachment to the MSA, and we all recognize that Jack could not force the other partners, what would be the effect of having those attachments mirror each other? The legal consequence from that, that flowed from that.
If the attachments mirrored each other, we would at least get out of the briar patch of a trial court changing the terms of a mediated settlement agreement, which under established Texas precedent is disallowed. We would at least get out of that problem, but we would still be stuck with the problem that the trial court is looking at an agreement that comports with 6602, but is impossible to perform.
In order for you to ultimately win, following that logic, you still have to allow traditional contract defenses to void the decree, because there is no practical consequence to the fact that the attachments don't mirror each other. Is that right?
Well, I don't think our position is that generic common law contractual defenses can be used in a situation where you have a 6602 mediated settlement agreement, because you're right, that would absolutely take all the teeth out of 6602. But when you have a situation like this, where this isn't just a generic contractual defense, this is a concern about whether or not there is even a contract to begin with. There are two civil cases, City of Colony and Pickle versus Guarantee National Life Insurance Company, that both hold that when you have a material and essential term of a deal that is left out, that is based on a contingency, then you cannot have a contract to begin with. It can't be a final deal. So even if the documents, the exhibits, mirrored what was in the MSA, I still think the trial court, within its authority, even though 6602 says what it says, had to step back, look at that agreement, and say, this isn't just someone complaining about the deal. They, you know, they have buyer's remorse. They decided they didn't like it. There's not even a contract here to begin with.
Are there any posts?
If the exhibits were the same, that really wouldn't help.
If the exhibits were the same, I think that would at least get past the concern that the trial court exceeded its authority.
But it wouldn't help you when you're trying to get a different split of the property. It wouldn't help you there.
No, we would still be stuck with the position that the parties contracted for and negotiated for something that simply could not be performed, because just as Your Honor's pointed out, you know, Jack couldn't force these partners to consent to the deal.
So in order for you to win, we have to allow another defense into the equation here, and we've not spoken on it, but the CAs have, and that would be that where there is no meeting of the minds, there is no valid contract, and we would have to allow you to raise this traditional contract defense in the context of a 6602 MSA, correct?
I don't think so, because the Court of Appeals opinion is so narrow and so limited. You look at it, they're not really talking about no meeting of the minds in terms of the formation of the contract. When they say no meeting of the minds, if you look at the holding, they're really talking about the glaring difference between the decree and the MSA.
But you don't win, even if they were the same. You don't, even if they were the same, I guess I understand you to say you don't win anything. You can't win your lawsuit. You can't get a new.
Well, I think I still, okay, let me backtrack. If the trial court was presented with a decree with identical exhibits and it still signed off on it, I still think there would be a problem, because they signed off on a deal that was impossible to perform. And how can that be allowed to go forward that way?
I'm going to ask you one question, because your time's running out. If they had been the same, are there any post-decree causes of action that would arise? If they were the same, could you sue for tortious interference or something else or anything?
I don't I don't know whether or not tortious interference would play a part. I presume.
Or Joey Milner, I guess, isn't it?
Yeah, I presume there may be something in the civil context that would allow, or a motion to enforce the property division, but then we're stuck back to the same problem that there's this impossibility of performance. There wasn't a contract to begin with.
Is there an argument made that the signature of Jack's partners was necessarily implied? The parties agreed to transfer beneficial interest in record title. That can only happen if Jack and his partners all signed off, and the exhibit with consents included Jack's partners.
Absolutely.
Do you make that argument here?
Absolutely, because, again, we're back to these terms of art. When Jack says, I agree to transfer my beneficial interest in record title, and it's under this heading of required consent, that means unanimous consent. So I do believe that Jack was making a representation. I'm going to get unanimous consent. That's what I put in this MSA. I'm going to get this unanimous consent. And we have a couple options here. One, Jack really thought he was going to be able to, and then in the end he couldn't. Impossibility of performance. Two, he never intended to try to get those signatures. That he was trying to hoodwink Vicki this entire time. If that's the case, I think this case squarely falls under Boyd versus Boyd and is encouraging legal gamemanship to allow that deal to stand. And three, that something happened where Jack thought he was going to be able to get the signatures and then later changed his mind. And I think that's some kind of repudiation. Any which way you slice it, this deal rested squarely on a contingency that wound up that could not be performed. So there's not a contract to begin with. I don't think you're getting into the slippery slope of common law contractual defenses here. You can stop right here and say, first, the variance caused a problem, that the trial court overstepped its bounds, and two, it wasn't a contract to begin with.
Justice Lehrman, do you have a question?
That's okay, but thank you.
Are there any further questions? Thank you, counsel. The court will hear rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honor. Just a few brief points.
Actually, let me start with the question, if I may, counsel. The MSA said Vicki gets, quote, beneficial interest in record title. Do you agree?
Yes.
Is that possible to convey to her that without Jack and his partners all signing?
Yes.
It is?
Yes, and it was done right here in the exhibit to the divorce decree where Jack signed his name and he transferred all my beneficial interest in record title.
Did beneficial interest in record title in the partnership get conveyed?
Yes.
With only Jack signing?
Yes. No problem there.
You know, your opposing counsel adamantly disagrees on that point.
I know that.
Okay, explain.
The partnership agreement, partnership law is very clear. The partner can convey beneficial interest in record title to his partnership interest pursuant to a divorce decree, as part of a divorce decree. It's right there in the partnership agreement. We put it in our brief. The other partners do not have to consent. If they fail to consent and they elect a buyout provision, then the interest that has been transferred is going to be acquired by the partnership and considerations paid pursuant to provisions of the partnership agreement for that. So she wouldn't have it for more than, I think, 90 days.
If you prevail in this, isn't this going to encourage all kind of gamesmanship?
I don't believe so, Your Honor. That's why the litigants in this case and in almost all of these cases pursuant to the MSA are represented by lawyers. And in this case, very competent and very widely known divorce lawyers.
Who will learn how to play the game, right?
It's not a game. It's simply a question of, as interests are conveyed, whether they're business interests, whether they're personal property interests, real property interests, there are legal effects to those conveyances and transfers.
So you would say that Vicki Ann holds an asset that has no value?
No, I would not say that at
how
all.
How is it truly an asset? Without the signature of the partners?
It's a valuable asset. Potentially worth millions of dollars.
How so?
Because it's an interest in a limited partnership that's engaged in business with, I believe, millions of dollars of revenue that would ultimately be acquired and paid pursuant to the terms of the partnership agreement.
Does Vicki have a right to sit in Jack's old office, get his car allowance, and vote?
No. It was not negotiated. It wasn't included in the MSA. Absolutely.
That's included in the term beneficial interest in record title.
No, it's clearly not.
Would she be able to trigger a buyout provision on her own, or is that something that the partnership would have to do?
The partnership had the option, when an interest is conveyed pursuant to a divorce, to trigger a buyout provision. I don't believe Vicki had that option, but I'd have to go back and look. That hadn't been an issue that's been raised in the case.
I tried to stay away from family law work, but I was in practice, and this is one of the reasons why. But it just occurs to me that there's got to be lots of decrees out there that when they're entered, either pursuant to a settlement agreement or not, there are problems with them. And enforcing them, getting them carried out, partnership agreements, whatever. And there has got to be a procedure, I would guess, to go back to the court and say, we need some clarification here, some modification here.
And the family code provides for that in cases where the judge has divided property. You can go back and seek clarification of the judgment. Sometimes the judge awards property and there's problems with it. In a mediated settlement agreement, though, the purpose of the statute is to allow the parties themselves to make those decisions and to eliminate court tinkering, so to speak, right, with those things.
But by entering into an agreement that has inherent problems, what are the remedies for the parties? Are there none?
In this case, there's no inherent problem.
But if there were?
If it were impossible to perform.
If it were truly impossible to perform, then I suppose that would be raised. We have not briefed in this case whether that would be a legitimate defense. The courts, as I said earlier, no court of appeals has addressed that squarely where there's an impossibility. They have addressed situations where there's been fraudulent inducement or duress or illegality in the contract. If they agree to do something that was illegal, the courts will not enforce that. But other than those very narrow exceptions, the courts have enforced these agreements as written, as the trial court did in this case.
Do you disagree with the Court of Appeals that there's a difference in the terminology of the MSA, beneficial interest and record title, versus the terminology in the trial court judgment about assignment of limited partnership rights?
The trial court judgment.
Do you disagree that there's a difference in the terminology between the MSA and the trial court judgment?
No, it's identical. It's in fact, I just held it up a while ago. The language in the divorce decree exhibit is identical to the language in the MSA.
Any further questions? Thank you, counsel. The cause is submitted. That concludes the arguments for this morning, and the marshal will adjourn the court.
All rise. Oyez, oyez, oyez. The Honorable, the Supreme Court of Texas now stands adjourned.